You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 3rd of September. Despite pressure from hostage families, the Israeli public and even President Biden, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he won't make concessions to agree a ceasefire deal with Hamas. The mayor of Paris wants the Olympic rings to stay on the Eiffel Tower forever. And how to hold a fashion show in a war zone. Also in this podcast,
the bow of Titanic. That's what you think of when you think of the shipwreck. And it doesn't look like that anymore. It's just another reminder of the deterioration that's happening every day. People ask all the time, how long is Titanic going to be there? We don't know, but we're watching it in real time.
Underwater robots reveal how much the Titanic has decayed. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is under growing pressure to secure the release of the remaining hostages in Gaza after six were found dead in a tunnel on Saturday. Hostage families say their loved ones would still be alive if Mr. Netanyahu had not been so reluctant to reach a deal with Hamas. He has insisted the only way to prevent a repeat of the 7th of October massacre is to ensure the Palestinian group is totally defeated. But critics say he's stringing out negotiations in order to hold on to power. President Biden has added his voice to those calling on Mr. Netanyahu to do more. He was speaking to reporters as he arrived at the White House.
Are you planning to present a final hostage deal to the both sides this week?
We're very close to that.
What makes you think that this deal will be successful in a way that the other deals were not?
Hope springs eternal.
Mr. President, do you think it's time for Prime Minister Netanyahu to do more on this issue? Do you think he's doing enough?
No.
Well, Mr. Biden's comments came as thousands of Israelis took to the streets of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem after a day that saw many workers going on strike. But the Israeli Prime Minister shows no sign of being willing to compromise. In a TV address, he said Israel would not agree to a demand to withdraw from a narrow strip of land along the Gaza-Egypt border known as the Philadelphia Corridor.
What has changed in the last 5 days? What has changed? One thing. These murderers executed six of our hostages. They shot them in the back of the head. That's what's changed. And now after this, we're asked to show seriousness? We're asked to make concessions? What message does this send Hamas? It says, kill more hostages, murder more hostages, you'll get more concessions. The pressure internationally must be directed at these killers, at Hamas, not at Israel. We need maximum pressure on Hamas. I don't believe that either President Biden or anyone serious about achieving peace and achieving the release would seriously ask Israel, to make these concessions.
Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale is in Jerusalem. I asked him what he made of Mr. Netanyahu's speech.
What you heard, I think, this evening was a mixture of contrition, but also defiance. You had the contrition of a Prime Minister of Israel begging the forgiveness of the hostage families, those who lost their lives in recent days, and saying that Israel got very close to rescuing them, but in his words, not close enough, and asking the families for their forgiveness. He also tried to associate himself with the families, saying that he was part of what he called the community of the bereaved, an apparent reference to the fact that he lost his brother in an Israeli military operation many, many years ago, saying that, you know, he was part of that community, and only if you have suffered that kind of bereavement can you understand the pain and sorrow of what the families are going through. So there was that, but on the other hand, there was very, very defiant defence of his policy position, saying now is the time for unity. Now is not a time for cabinet ministers in Israel to squabble. And a very strong defence of the idea that if there is to be any ceasefire deal, Israeli forces have to remain in that border corridor in southern Gaza on the border with Israel, what he calls the Philadelphia Corridor. And it was an astonishing defense of that. The Prime Minister even sort of gave us a PowerPoint presentation about it with maps. And essentially his argument was that if Israel gives up control of that buffer zone, then Hamas will in future be able to continue rearming itself and remain a threat to Israel in the future. That is a defense of his position. It is not one held by many figures, senior figures in Israel's defense establishment. It is not an argument that is supported by the families of the hostages, who say, no, that simply doesn't wash, and that actually what needs to happen now, the greater priority, is to secure the release of those hostages. Otherwise, more are going to die, as happened in recent days.
You mentioned the families, some in the military. He's also facing pressure from Joe Biden, people on the streets in Israel, and some in his own cabinet. Where does it go from here?
Well, the supporters of the hostages and those people who are on the streets of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv tonight hope that we've reached a tipping point. But I have to say, we have reached these moments before so far in this war. And thus far, the government led by Benjamin Netanyahu has not shifted its position. What's been interesting is that while the political pressure continues, the economic pressure today was perhaps less than some had hoped for. Yes, there was a general strike, and this was the first time this had happened since the war began. But it was patchy. It was not deep. It was not a comprehensive strike. So the economic pressure isn't there yet. The political pressure, though, does continue. But all the signs now is that he remains defiant, and he thinks he'll keep enough political support for that argument until he doesn't, and then he will change.
James Landau in Jerusalem. Since the outbreak of the war in Gaza, radical Israeli settlers have seized the opportunity to take over land in the other, much larger Palestinian territory, the occupied West Bank, forcing Palestinians from their homes. Instead of the traditional urban settlements, they are establishing what are called herding outposts, with the intention of controlling large tracts of land. While the settlements are illegal, BBC Eye Investigations has found evidence that they are supported by an Israeli government-funded organisation. Emir Nader reports.
Mohammed is playing an audio message on his phone. Listen, the voice says, I will tell you this only once. You have 2 days to leave the area. Mohammed's mother, Aisha, wonders if it's a settler they know well.
He's a settler called Moshe, but we call him Musa. He's the one who kicked us out.
In October 2023, a few days after the Hamas attack on Israel, Aisha and her husband Nabil were forced off their land in the Jordan Valley. Recently, the couple were able to briefly return home. In the kitchen, all the cupboard doors have been thrown open and the drawers pulled out. In the living room, the sofas have been slashed so that the foam stuffing shows through. Outdoors, her husband Nabil points to where the tap has been snapped off the water tank and the solar panels have been smashed.
This farmland is mine. 10 dunams here, 20 dunams there, and 10 dunams around the house. That's my home.
They were kicked out at gunpoint, Aisha says, and she accuses a local settler of putting a gun to her head. The man she's accusing is called Moshe Sharvit, an Israeli settler in his late 20s. In this video published on his website, he presents an idyllic view of life in the rich agricultural landscape of the West Bank. But the group of farm buildings that he set up, what's known as a herding outpost, is illegal under Israeli law. And we've discovered how some settlers like Moshe Sharvit have received support from powerful groups. One of them, the World Zionist Organization, is more than 100 years old. One of its key departments is the Settlement Division, funded by the Israeli government.
It's a body which runs very, very, very big part of a land which had been expropriated by the Israeli authorities in the West Bank, to different Israeli settlements or settlers.
This is Dror Eskes, an Israeli activist who tracks the construction of Israeli settlements and outposts. The BBC has seen documents that show how the WZO has allocated large areas of land in the occupied West Bank to settlers. They forbid the building of any structures.
The red stains on the map, yeah? This is here. This is where we are right now.
Dror Etkes shows us a contract on his mobile phone between the WZO and a settler whose name's been redacted, so we can't be sure if it's Moshe Sharvit, but it does match the date he moved to the area.
There's only one settler here in the area where it's heard. This is Moshe Sharvit.
Moshe Sharvit has been sanctioned by the UK, accused of forcing around 20 Palestinian families off their land. But we found a pattern of other settlers who've established illegal outposts on land allocated by the WZO. Two of those settlers have also recently been sanctioned by the UK for violence against local Palestinians. The WZO didn't respond to our questions. To get to Moshe Sharvit's outpost, you have to drive up a long, winding gravel track. He hasn't responded to any of our attempts to try and speak with him, so now is our chance to try and put our questions to him. Moshe comes to meet us outside the farm gate. His brother David follows him, filming us on his mobile. He has an assault rifle over one shoulder. Moshe has a handgun stuck in his waistband.
We've spoken to a lot of the Palestinian families here who say that you've used violence on them and forced them out of their homes.
Maybe it's a different Moshe. I don't know him.
It was definitely you. We filmed you. We've spoken to a Palestinian woman who says you put a gun to her head.
I'm sorry. I don't know about it. Maybe it's another Moshe. There are a lot of Moshes here. It's a very common name in Israel.
It is unquestionably Moshe Sharvit. The Moshe Sharvit who appears in his own promotional videos. He says again that he doesn't know what I'm talking about and turns away. Since October, settlers have stepped up their efforts to build illegal outposts in the West Bank. But despite international sanctions, they remain undeterred and increasingly powerful.
Emir Nader reporting. Relations between Finland and its giant neighbour Russia took a downturn when Russian troops launched their full-scale invasion of Ukraine 2.5 years ago. Finland imposed sanctions, expelled Russian diplomats, and eventually joined NATO, much to President Putin's anger. Now the Finnish government says it intends to stop Russian citizens buying property in Finland in order to protect national security. I heard more from our reporter Rooster Puka.
The main problem is not the number of these properties. There aren't that many of them, about 3,500, but where they are, and many of them are in very strategic locations like near air force bases, garrisons, main power lines, and even the main shipping lane between Finland and Sweden. And the concerns about the threat they pose, it's pretty realistic. About a year ago, if you remember, a Russian manned vessel cut the main electricity cable between Finland and Estonia. There's also been more or less constant and massive jamming of GPS signals in the region. A couple of months ago, the Finnish carrier Finnair had to stop its flight to Tartu in Estonia because of that. And add to that the fact that Russians have been caught flying drones over nuclear power stations in Sweden and military areas in Norway. So I'd say most Finns are pretty worried.
Now, this is just currently a proposal. So will it happen? And if so, how much difference will it make?
It will absolutely happen. The government has got a very clear majority in Parliament, and these measures have already been widely debated, and they are supported by the main opposition parties. There have been some queries from some legal specialists, but they are mainly to do with detail of the proposals. These are not seen as controversial moves, but ones that are essential for Finland's security. Hopefully, I think this is what the government is thinking, this will put a stop to a development that has been allowed to go on for too long.
And it feeds into the wider dispute between the two countries. Have we had any reaction from Russia, and what do people in Finland make of it?
There's been no reaction from Moscow today. I mean, previously, the Russians have said that any restrictions on them buying property in Finland is a gross human rights violation. As far as relations with Russia and what Finns think about them are concerned, I don't think Finns really see that there is a dispute just between their country and Russia. The overwhelming majority would say that Russia is waging an illegal war of conquest against Ukraine. This, of course, is something Finns say they have been subjected to countless times over the centuries, and that the dispute is between those upholding, seeking to uphold at least, a rules-based international order and those seeking to destroy it.
Rooster Poker. The mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, has provoked controversy in the French capital by saying she wants to keep the Olympic rings on the Eiffel Tower as a permanent fixture after the Games are over. Parisians are divided on the idea.
This Eiffel Tower is quite beautiful decorated in these Olympic rings. Above all, the values conveyed by them are fabulous. It's our way of showing our attachment to these international values of peace, of solidarity. So yeah, I think it's a great idea.
Maintenant que les Jeux Olympiques et les Jeux Paralympiques vont être terminés,
Now that the Olympic Games and the Paralympic Games are going to finish, I think we have to move on. I'm not for keeping the rings after the games are over.
The five rings weigh 30 tons, so why does Anne Hidalgo want to keep them on the Eiffel Tower? Hugh Schofield is our Paris correspondent.
Well, I suppose a cynic would say because she doesn't want the party to end. You know, it's like somebody the day after Christmas wishing Christmas could be extended into Boxing Day. It's been a very successful Olympic Games. She's obviously high on the buzz of it all. You know, for once people have been talking up the French experience, the Paris experience, and that is an experience she wants to perpetuate. That's, I guess, a cynical view. I mean, maybe she would respond by saying, no, we think the rings have a proper place on the Eiffel Tower, and it was such an important Olympic Games that they deserve to stay there, but I suspect that history will treat this idea rather less kindly. You know, time moves on, the Olympics will be forgotten, and I think I can't imagine how in a year from now they would look appropriate there at all.
Yeah, I mean, who has the final say over whether they could stay on the Eiffel Tower?
In theory, I think she does, because the Eiffel Tower does belong to the city of Paris. But, you know, there is a wave of opposition, spearheaded by not least the culture minister, that's Rachida Dati, who's a long-time enemy of Anne Hidalgo in the Paris City Hall. And Rachida Dati is pointing out that apart from belonging to the city of Paris, the monument is also a historic monument, which is covered by all sorts of rules. And therefore, the city, even though it owns it, can't just willy-nilly do what it wants with it. So, I mean, it's shaping up, if Anne Hidalgo persists, to be a big legal battle about whether or not they can stay there. Rachida Dati says that the permission to put them up thus far was a kind of gesture towards the Olympic Games, but it was only ever intended that they be there in a kind of temporary way.
And do we know what happens to the rings normally after an Olympics?
I don't know the general story of the Olympic rings, but I know that after the London Olympic Games, they were taken down and recycled. There were some at St Pancras Station which were taken down and apparently were turned into seating, coloured seating at St Pancras Station. So you can actually still go and sit on an Olympic ring in the environs of St Pancras Station. But otherwise, they just get taken down and repurposed. I'm sure that's what's happened in every other city. And it does seem, I suspect, probably what's going to happen here too.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. A British woman is thought to have set a new world record for the fastest female swim across Lake Geneva. Sam Farrow took 22 hours and 48 minutes to cover a distance of almost 73 kilometres. She only stopped to tread water while having food or drink, or occasionally to roll up into a ball to bend her spine because of cramp and backache. She's been talking to Sarah Montague.
When we booked the swim originally, I just wanted to see how far I could go. I wanted to see if I could finish it. Never in my wildest dreams did I think I would be the fastest woman. We went about 5 hours faster than I was expecting. I think it was just a really good combination of good weather, good currents, and just being stronger than I thought I was. It just goes to show what your body can achieve. My longest previous swim was about 36 kilometres. So everything after that was unknown for myself and the crew. About 55K, my back really started to fatigue. And that's when, yeah, the cramps and the pain really started. I think your mind gives in long before your body gives in. So if you can keep your head positive, you can get there in the end. So every time that my brain tried to tell me that I couldn't do it, I just tried to try and flip it and think, right, it's 4 a.m. You're in the middle of Lake Geneva. How special is this? Not many people get the chance to do this. And I was also really lucky that I had two women on my crew, Jane and Claire, who alternated. Claire would swim for an hour with me, and then my friend Jane would get in the kayak and kayak for an hour with me. So I was never on my own.
And then the feeling when you did it, what was that like?
Utter relief that I was on dry land. But also, I don't think it's quite kicked in yet. I've not really had the emotions yet. I think it's all a bit of a shock still.
Is there a next swim?
There definitely will be. We'll plan another big swim for next year. If we can do 70K, let's see how far we can go, really. But it's just finding the right location and boats and crews and things. So we'll see.
Sam Farrow talking to Sarah Montague. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
Everyone I know who uses X gets a bit lost between what is real and what is fake. If Elon Musk wants to come here and thinks this is a banana republic, he's wrong.
How do Brazilians feel about the banning of X? The wreck of the Titanic was found in 1985, more than 70 years after it sank on its maiden voyage in the North Atlantic. The latest expedition to the wreck site on the ocean floor has revealed the slow decay of the liner's famous bow. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, was given exclusive access to footage taken by underwater robots.
It's the image that made Titanic instantly recognisable. The bow of the doomed liner looming out of the darkness of the Atlantic deep. But this image has changed forever. A 4.5 metre long section of railing is now missing from the front of the ship, having tumbled to the seafloor. The expedition team thinks it fell at some point in the last 2 years. Dives in 2022 showed the railing intact but buckling. The loss is a consequence of the ongoing deterioration of the ship. After 112 years beneath the waves, it's being eroded by salt water and microbes are eating away at the huge metal structure. Thomasina Ray is the director of collections at RMS Titanic Inc., who carried out the expedition.
You have all these moments in pop culture, and it's just iconic to see the bow of Titanic. That's what you think of when you think of the shipwreck, and it doesn't look like that anymore. It's just another reminder of the deterioration that's happening every day. People ask all the time, how long is Titanic going to be there? We don't know, but we're watching it in real time.
The expedition gathered more than 2 million images and hours of footage of the wreck. It's still being reviewed to catalogue the finds, but the team has announced one major discovery, a 60-centimetre tall bronze statue called the Diana of Versailles, which once adorned the first-class lounge. The figure was found lying face-up in the debris field that surrounds the wreck.
Our science editor, Rebecca Morell. The social media platform X is facing the loss of one of its largest markets in an argument over hate speech and disinformation. On Friday, Brazil's telecom regulator suspended access to it for the country's 200-plus million people after a ruling by a senior judge. On Monday, the Brazilian Supreme Court upheld that ruling. It's being seen as the most serious crisis yet for Elon Musk's platform. Our business reporter David Waddell has the story.
When Elon Musk took control of Twitter 2 years ago in a $44 billion deal, rebranding it X, he signalled there would be far fewer restrictions on what people could post. Mr. Musk calls himself a free speech absolutist, as he told the BBC's James Clayton last year.
Free speech is meaningless unless you allow people you don't like to say things you don't like. Otherwise, it's irrelevant. And if at the point at which you lose free speech, it doesn't come back.
Since then, the platform and its owner have faced constant controversy. Individuals banned from Twitter, including controversial influencer Andrew Tate and UK far-right activist Tommy Robinson, were reinstated by X. During violent far-right protests this summer in the UK, Mr. Musk found himself in a row with Prime Minister Keir Starmer after posting that civil war is inevitable and accusing the government of two-tier policing. Mr. Musk's latest row threatens X's position in one of its biggest markets.
Liberdade de expressão.
Over the weekend, Brazilian Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes ordered the platform to be shut down across the country. It comes after a months-long feud over alleged misinformation and hate speech on the platform, in which Mr. Musk called the judge an evil dictator.
People my age aren't really in the habit of watching TV news or reading the news, and Twitter, or X, was a way at least for me to get news from around the world. So I've lost touch a little with what's happening around the world and a way of entertaining myself.
X was a much freer space for various forms of speech. So much so that there was a lot of discrimination. So honestly, I do see a positive side to Twitter being shut down. But there were also many good movements, campaigns and NGOs that have lost their space.
Everyone I know who uses X gets a bit lost between what is real and what is fake. But I don't think it has to be all or nothing. There could be some regulation there. If Elon Musk wants to come here and thinks this is a banana republic, he's wrong.
By the way, the arrest in France last month of Pavel Durov, CEO of messaging app Telegram, has raised the stakes in the debate. France has rejected claims that CEO can't be held responsible for illegal content shared on the platform. But Elon Musk hinted on X over the weekend that it's probably wise for me to limit movements to countries where free speech is constitutionally protected.
David Waddell reporting. The last time Ukraine staged its own Fashion Week was back in 2022. But after 3 seasons on the road in London, Paris, Copenhagen and Berlin, the event is now finally back in Kyiv. Safety measures include equipping venues with bomb shelters. Many designers expect their shows to be interrupted by the sounds of sirens, but say they'll just start up again immediately afterwards. So what's it like holding a fashion event in a war zone? We heard from two Ukrainian designers who are attending, Julie Yarmoluyuk, owner of the brand Jamem, as well as Elvira Gasanova, a designer originally from Donetsk, now living in Kyiv.
It was difficult because of that. When you do some fashion show in different countries, it's not about your show because you can't invite your clients. You can't do all that you can when you do it in your home, because tomorrow I will have my show in Kyiv and we do our big show with a lot of clients, with a lot of celebrities, Ukrainian celebrities, with a lot of friends of the brand. And it's really another part of all that we're doing. And if someone tell that it's not okay because it's war in Ukraine, we know that it's really important for us because it's really important part of our business.
Just this morning, Kyiv was under heavy shell, and yet we continue to push forward. And I am proud to be a part of Ukrainian Fashion Week's return to Kyiv. It's a powerful statement that despite the hardships, we continue to create and stay rooted in our culture. We want to highlight that Ukraine is a home of talented, creative people who can produce something truly unique and valuable, no matter of the dark times in Ukraine.
Julia, you say it's an important symbol, but is anyone in Ukraine, what with there being a war on, thinking much about fashion? I mean, are people buying things?
Of course, people buying. So we have to live from day to day. We have shows that stay tuned in this world, no matter way, no matter the circumstances. We have to show our culture to the whole world, and mission of designers to light this process.
Yeah, I think that a lot of our clients right now just live every day like their last day, and they really want to celebrate their birthday, their special events, like super events, really. That's why they buy a lot of clothes. They understand that you never know what will be tomorrow.
Just finally, but maybe a slightly strange question, Julie, has the war actually influenced what is fashionable, what people are wearing? Of course, so many people are involved in the armed forces now. We keep seeing Volodymyr Zelensky, the president, on TV wearing the same sort of dark green T-shirt with the cargo pants. I mean, has that had an influence on Ukrainian fashion?
I think that First Lady Olena Zelenska is showing her position in negotiations when she's wearing a dark green and just Ukrainian designers. It's very important to all of us.
Ukrainian fashion designers Julie Yarmoluyuk and Elvira Gasanova talking to Luke Jones. One of the astronauts stranded on the International Space Station has reported a strange noise coming from Boeing's Starliner spacecraft. Butch Wilmore contacted Mission Control in Houston to share his concerns just days before the faulty vehicle is due to undock and attempt to return to Earth unmanned. Here's the moment Butch relayed the mystery sounds to administrators on the ground.
All right, Butch, that one came through. It was kind of like a pulsing noise, almost like a sonar ping.
Yeah, I'll do it one more time, and I'll let y'all scratch your heads and see if you can figure out what's going on. Here we go.
Well, the U.S. Space Agency has now released a statement apparently clearing up the mystery. Former NASA astronaut Colonel Caddy Coleman spoke to Evan Davis.
What you're hearing is feedback from the speaker, and it's an audio configuration between the space station and the Starliner. And that doesn't surprise me a bit, in that you would think, you know, a radio, we've had them for a long time, but it's a pretty complicated beast up on the space station, and it's connecting the Russian segment, the Japanese segment, the European segment, and now the Starliner. I mean, there's still things to learn, and apparently this week another thing was learned.
Yeah, I mean, obviously online people had lots of theories. It's an alien with a decapitated head outside the craft, banging it on the side. All of those kind of crazy ones. But tell us about the sound when you're up there. Are there lots of noises, or is it incredibly quiet on the space station?
I would never say it's quiet up there, in that we have a lot of white noise from the fans, because we have to circulate the air quite well, because we need to scrub out the CO2 that we breathe out. So there's a lot of air movement, which is good. That means there's a lot of fan noise, and they've done their best to minimize that fan noise, but it's still very much some white noise. But I think as folks that live up there, I mean, spaceflight is still, we're always learning things. And every time you notice something that's unexpected, we report that to the ground so that they can understand that, oh, this mechanism that was always easy to operate is suddenly stiff. Or I'm hearing this thing, you know, when you go to the mechanic and you say, you know, my car is making this sound. And I thought it was really great that they could actually play the sound for mission control. And so it's kind of our job to notice those things. We're at the edge, you know, the dozen people that are up in space right now are the furthest away from Earth. And their job is to notice stuff for all of us.
Former astronaut Caddy Coleman. And that's all from us for now. But the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Richard Hamilton. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.